I am shivering, and I feel nauseous. My children, the economic factor is not a sustainable argument. I think about climate change and this disaster.
The components of social welfare need to be changed. The developing world should no longer be using the same criterion the developed world has defined as welfare for its people and follow their footsteps.
If we take an overall look, I think any project, any move, any industrialization, any process or any technology should calculate the temperature rise on the Earth in proportion with the delta T quotient.
Finally, humans can go on living for a week or two without food and a few days without water, but without air, we can't but survive for a minute. It is the most vital of anything the Earth's atmosphere has provided us with. We're using it, but on the other hand, we're destroying it, badly, and with high cost. We place it into a poorly manufactured man-made combustion device and receive toxic chemicals on the other side, which remains. It remains and moves around, and the Earth has no way to get rid of some of these toxic chemicals we've produced.
The economy has limited all activities to itself, and those who speak about the impact on the environment and the earth just talk and hold summits, but practically it's almost useless.
Concern. Just concern. What does that mean? What does being concerned mean? Static concern is meaningless. Concern should be dynamic. If you're concerned, you should do something to reduce that concern. That's a dynamic solution, not a static one. A static solution just adds to your concern and accumulates and is useless. Concern must be dynamic. What does dynamic mean? It means you must seek a real solution for it. It means you need to have a program.
I believe that if we carry on like this, making the earth sick and failing to do anything about this sickness, we'll be deeply ashamed in front of our next generations. They've had no role in bringing about this situation, yet they have to bear the consequences. Consequences that are getting worse by the day. So I can't do anything but apologize to the next generation who might be watching this film for the disasters that my generation is causing the environment and the earth.
I don't understand why my children are destroying the one and only home that they have. As my children, they have closed their eyes to the facts. Don't use your planet in the wrong way. We are a part of you, not separated from you.
The Earth has been stable and balanced due to its ecosystem. It carried on with its life way before we ever came along and started hurting and destroying it. Finally, just like a pendulum will do, if you place it out of balance, it will try to balance itself, reach its lowest energy level and become balanced.
The Earth is our mother. It's beautiful, it's a creator, it's merciful, and we in return are being very bad children.
Thank you. Well, it's perfectly true that every single one of us citizens of the Earth must do our share to reduce pollution. But to curb global warming and avoid its dire consequences, the countries most responsible must make an effort. The U.S. has caused more global warming than any other country. Research shows that from 1850 to the year 2011, the United States, a single country, produced 27% of the total carbon dioxide emissions of the world. No other single country was even close. Indeed, the U.S. even outdistanced all the nations of the European Union combined. Well, that's a wrap for this week, but join me again next week here on Aperture. Goodbye for now.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars from IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints, an analysis on the thoughts and speeches of the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. With me in the studio are two guest speakers for today's discussion, Brother Ali Alevian and Brother Suhail Sarani. Brother Suhail, assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to the show.
Assalamu rahmatullah. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And Brother Ali, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me here.
So Brother Mahmoud, the producer of this program, dedicated this new series of the program Viewpoints in the whole month of Ramadan to the topic which is rarely discussed, we can say, in the academic fields and also Islamic fields, and that is the book Nahjul Balagha and the significance of this book as tackled by the leader of Iran on different occasions and his different speeches. When you get to the text of Nahjul Balagha and through the character of Imam Ali alayhi salam, you want to know Islam, I think you have an authentic source now. But when you get to Nahjul Balagha and the very character of Imam Ali alayhi salam, then you can find how practical could a person be and be obedient to his master, that is Allah, and then the Prophet of Allah, that is Prophet Muhammad.
Exactly.
This is unfortunately what is missed in today's world, you know. When we want to refer into the interpretation of Islam, we start from the various scholars that live in our contemporary time.
You know, in one of the tradition, I would paraphrase that Imam Ali alayhi salam says that know the truth and you will know the people of truth.
Mm-hmm. People
so,
of truth,
so there's
that's right.
There's the right methodology of knowing, you know, looking at Islam, that you need to know the truth,
mm-hmm.
and then you will know who were on truth and who were those personalities.
That's
and
right.
Very rightly mentioned in one of the tradition, we also see that, and again I'm paraphrasing, where our holy infallible alayhi salam says, if you present our sayings and our teachings to people as they are, then the beauty of them would make people follow us. You know, so that's very obvious. Like when you present the content to the world, and they'll definitely, you know, Reber also mentions in one of his speeches that those who are, those who are criticizing Islam, or those who have some issue, and then they are pinpointing each and everything about Islam.
That's right.
Before doing that, I would like to tell them, and he clearly mentioned that, you know, go and tell my words to them. Go and say them, tell this to them, those who are like, you know, in the Reformation, you know, quote unquote, like they call
That's
it,
right.
call themselves as reformative camp or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Go between them. And, you know, tell them that, you know, before doing this criticism, read once this book, Nahjul Balagha, and then see if you can criticize.
Any comments?
I just want to take this opportunity to say one word to the brothers or sisters who are listening to us, and to say that in case, I'm talking to all the Muslim brothers, whatever they are and wherever they live, whether they are, for example, follower of the Ahlul Bayt or not. They are from Shia or Sunni brothers and sisters. I want to tell them, if they want to look at the history of Islam in a just manner, by a just person, I just want to recommend them to read this book of Nahjul Balagha. Actually, Nahjul Balagha, the importance of history is quite clear to everybody, that if you work on the history, specifically the history of Islam, actually it works like a torch of guidance for you. So it's good to know the history of Islam first. But if you want to, for example, regardless of what faith or what sect you are following or what your beliefs are, just see this book and read this book and see if the person who is actually talking to you and narrating the history of his time is just or not.
In fact, many of the Ahlul Sunnah brothers and sisters, they also believe that Imam Ali was the most
knowledgeable,
highest rank sahaba of Prophet Muhammad.
Yeah, that's mentioned.
So yeah.
Definitely, they know that he was among the virtuous and the among the virtuous and let's say the most excellent companion of the Holy Prophet. But I want to invite them to look at this companion of the Holy Prophet with a new eye. Because
from a new perspective.
From a new perspective, actually. Here we see Imam Ali alayhi salam, to some extent, when he actually talks to you, he talks about the history of that time. He talks about the policies that a Muslim leader needs to take at the time that he is the leader of the Islamic Ummah. Why? Because we are in need of knowing what happened at the dawn of Islam. And history will help us. As I said, it is a torch of guidance for us. And we are in need of knowing our background, our history, to see what happened to us and what. So by this, actually, we are preventing any other probable damage that might come to Islam and Islam world. So here we are actually immunizing and guaranteeing the safety of the Islamic Ummah. So when we understand that what is the duty of a duty bound, what is the duty of a Muslim at the time that he lives, because the leader of the Islam, because the Islamic leader tells you how, what's your obligations and what's your commitments in the Islam world. And beautifully, Imam Ali alayhi salam actually portrays the duties of a Muslim at his time, and it is working till today.
And it is not only beneficial for the Muslim lands, but the non-Muslim lands too, because there are some speeches and the words in Nahjul Balagha which are addressed to the humanity and the human beings in general.
Brother, when
se.
A true word is being said, it doesn't matter who is your adversary,
yes.
Whether it is a Muslim.
I do want to say even the non-Muslims
but since,
can benefit from
why
this
did
book.
I actually address my Muslim brothers and sisters as my audience? Because
yes.
They know about Imam Ali. At least
yeah.
They have heard of him.
Yes.
But for anyone with any taste that
yes.
wants to look at Najib Balagha, he's free to come and take from this ocean.
You know what is the interesting point is that when ISIS was established in Iraq and Syria, when you look at what they did, and when you refer to Nahjul Balagha of Imam Ali talking about the Kharijites, you can see the very much same significance, characteristics among them of the people who are...
Exactly, that's interestingly you mentioned how Rehber says in
yes.
one of his speeches, he says like during today's time,
mm-hmm.
we have one slogan all over, you can listen to this slogan, it's a similar slogan. But then the directions are so different from each other. Direction of Muslim countries,
yes.
and Muslim groups,
yes.
are so different from each other that it's very high time that we need a guideline. And, the Nahjul Balagha can play that part of torch-bearing things for us in today's time, because he drew parallel between that time and the time we
That's
are living
right.
now.
And this time.
Yeah.
That's all right.
And
okay.
just wanted to add this as well, because he mentions very nicely, he says, it gives you two very important, takeaway from Nahjul Balagha.
Mm-hmm.
And the first part is your foundational, core foundation of Islamic viewpoint or worldview. You know, how your Tawhid is, how you
yes.
Look at Nabuwat,
yes.
how you like look at prophethood and such, right? And then, more importantly, another part is the implementation in your practical life.
That's right.
So that's what you take out from Nahjul Balagha, because
okay.
Imam Ali lived up to that life,
mm-hmm.
and he practically lived, as well as he, mentioned everything during his various occasions. He delivered those sermons and letters to different people during his 4 years or about 5 years government.
That's all right. Brother Ali, is this book, unreadable in some of the Muslim lands? I mean, is it forbidden to read?
I haven't seen anywhere to see it, for example, banned or, I don't know, to be forbidden in any, at least I have not seen anything like that, or I have not yet heard of it.
Okay.
But the problem is that it is not known to Muslims. This book is not that, I mean, the book.
You know what is the question? The question is that maybe for the Muslim lands, this book and the people around the world, I mean, even Muslims, Nahjul Balagha is considered like the other books of Ahadith.
Yeah.
Like what we have of Bukhari and Muslim among the Sunni,
yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
And so many books of Ahadith among the Shia ones. Maybe this book is looked as a mere, we can say, akhbari, or we can say a narrative book.
I wish it was seen as a, for example, hadith book among them, and it was known as a hadith book among the Muslims. But the problem is that this book is not that known among the Muslims. They have not heard of it. For example, I remember once I talked to some scholars from the Islam world earlier. When I was referring to Nahjul Balagha, he was asking what Nahjul Balagha is. So it seems that we have not, actually we as Muslims, and specifically the followers of the school of Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam, have not yet worked a lot to introduce this book to humanity. So it is our duty to do our share and to do our duty and to propagate and promote this book to humankind, not, and specifically the Muslims who know Imam Ali alayhi salam, at least as some as the leader of the Islamic Command right after the Prophet, and some at least as the Khalifa of the Holy Prophet. So they know Imam Ali alayhi salam to some extent, and it's more understandable for them if we tell them that this is the book that has been collected from sayings of Imam.
That's right.
But unfortunately, the problem is that it is even not understood. Brother, let the whole world aside, but those who claim to be the follower of Imam inside the country,
to
what extent are people actually are familiar with Nahjul Balagha? In some of our families and houses, we have not yet even one copy of it at home.
Mm-hmm.
So when a Christian scholar like George Jordaq reads it 200 times, and he is still thirsty of reading it more, 220 some, if I'm not mistaken, and he's still thirsty of reading it more, it means that I have not yet understood the importance and the value of this book to make it that important for me, for my family. To read it, for example, in daily or weekly or monthly basis for my children.
That's
or
right.
To teach it at the schools. It is not even yet being taught at the schools in this Muslim country.
Yeah,
that
for
we
the young
are
generation.
It's true that in some schools, actually, there are some competitions from some sermons or some words, but it is not a textbook for our students.
Or have
yet.
Not been translated to different languages.
Unfortunately, okay. It has not. Into English, I know it has been translated, but the translation, it's not good to be actually broadcasted, but they are very poor. Actually, translations of Nahjul Balagha are not as good as translations which have been made on Quran.
That's right.
But I think it's good to invite those who are able to come and invest at least on the translation of this great and important book. And it's good to be translated into different languages, to different people, not only to the languages which are being talked and are accents in Islam world. No, to different languages it has to be translated, inshallah.
Al-Imam Ali alayhi salam, Sotul Adalatul Insaniya. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the voice of the human justice.
Very true.
This
George
is
Jordaq.
The title of the book of George Jordaq, which was also translated into Persian language and also English language. And as you said, George Jordaq, after writing so many times, the Nahjul Balagha got understood that Ali is the symbol of justice for all the Muslims around the world. And this is the important point. We can say if one truly research and search into the content of Nahjul Balagha, he can be familiar with the true picture of Islam and the true successor to Prophet Muhammad. And this is very important. Okay, Brother Suhaib, we got about 2-3 minutes. 1 minute? 1-2 minutes for your final remarks?
Finally, I would like to reiterate the same thing that as Brother Ali said. Now, when you look at the statements of Imam Khamenei and the lot of emphasis that he puts on Nahjul Balagha, I mean, I myself feel that, I should beside, like we have a habit of reciting Quran during month of Ramadan.
Yes.
We should also have, one or two iteration of reading Nahjul Balagha as
That's
well.
Right.
And inshallah we get tawfiq that during this leftover we can use the best of, we can make the best use of our time and, you know, dwell into this precious gem, inshallah.
That's all right. Thank you very much, Brother Sohail.
Thank you.
And Brother Ali for your presence in the program Viewpoints.
Thanks to you, brother.
The book of Nahjul Balagha, compiled by Sayyida Razi, may Allah bless him. He was really a great scholar and author. He has also so many other books. But among, you know, what a tawfiq Sayyida Razi had to select and to, we can say, compile Nahjul Balagha. And, you know, in the house of the Shias, whenever you look, you can say in the bookshelf, beside the Holy Quran, there is one volume of Nahjul Balagha. And this is very important, okay? The point and the tawfiq that this scholar, Sayyida Razi, had. May Allah bless his soul, and also his brother, Sharif al-Murtadha. Two great brothers who, you can say, were the source of benefit for the upcoming generations of the scholars after themselves. So this is our program on Nahjul Balagha, as was addressed by the leader of Iran on different occasions, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. For more information on this program and on other episodes, you can visit our website at parstudio.com/Ian Call of Islam Radio, also our YouTube channel, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanullah.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The month of Allah presents Ahkam, Islamic Commandments of Fasting by Hujjatul Islam Khakdaman.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Alhamdulillah, thank God that we have another opportunity to talk and to think and to study about the ahkam, about the religious matters, especially in the month of Ramadan, that we have this honor and this blessing to be in. Previously, like in last episode, let me say, not much further, we talked about the fasts that are forbidden, they are haram. In this episode, I'm going to especially talk about parents and children, and the manner between them, you know, the how they behave each other. Now specifically about the child, because we were talking about the fasts that are forbidden for the child. Now, the recommended fasts, when it becomes forbidden, when it becomes very much recommended to avoid and not do it, when children fast a recommended one, but it is against the parents' will, and it makes them bothered, it makes them hurt, it makes them annoyed in some way. You know, in any way possible, it makes them very irritated and angry and mad, right? In this case, if you are fasting, and that kind of fasting makes your parents, makes your father or your mother bothered, hurt, or mad, angry, any one of them, then not only you cannot fast, but this fast is haram for you. You are not gaining something, you are losing something. You are not receiving a blessing, you are receiving punishment later if you do this. Now, why this happens? Why bothering the parents is such a paid attention to matter in our religion? You know, in Holy Quran, God says, وَلَا تَقُلْ لَهُمَا أُفٍّ, right? Don't tell them, don't tell your parents, your mother, your father, uff. Now, this uff is the smallest amount of impliedness and rudeness towards your parents. And even we cannot do this. And we are talking specifically about the matter of idha, means bothering your parents. It is haram, and it is one of the biggest harams in our religion, because our parents have done a lot for us, and they are very important in the eyes of God, so that the children do respect a lot. The children return the favor as much as they can. The children should be grateful and show gratitude towards their parents, right? So imagine that I am having a recommended fast, and for any reason, my father or my mother says, I do not want you to fast. I want you to go somewhere, for example, do something for me. I want you to come with me and to, for example, drink this, eat this. I want you to do something which is against fasting. You know, I don't want you to fast. I am more important. You should help me. Don't fast. If you fast, it is haram. So the smallest amount of bothering the parents is haram, let alone the bigger botherings. Because I see in the society nowadays that children has become something very ordinary for them to neglect the parents, to ignore them, not pay attention to them, not to treat them and behave them in a way that it is good and pleasant and recommended, not with respect, not, you know, with courtesy. But nowadays, unfortunately, they say what they want in any tone they want, you know, because they have forgotten the mercy and the kindness that the parents showed them. In the accounts of Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them, when we go to the accounts and study them, we see that, like, after worshiping God, after paying attention to God's satisfaction, you know, paying attention to the parents and helping them and being there when they need us is the most important thing. So in month of Ramadan, since it's very holy and a good practicing ground for us, it is very good, like a bonus for us, to pay more attention to our parents and make them happy and proud. Thank you so very much and goodbye.
Israel's occupation of Palestine and the plight of Palestinians have once again come into focus globally as people worldwide mark the International Quds Day. Every year, on the last Friday of the fasting month of Ramadan, pro-Palestinian groups from all faiths show solidarity with those affected by the occupation. The issue of Palestine is today recognized as one of the most complicated crises that seems far from any kind of resolution. But when did it all begin? The mass displacement of Palestinians from their ancestral lands mainly dates back to May 14, 1948, when Israel was created in Palestine and immediately recognized by the United States. Palestine had been under British colonial control until May that year. Britain had long encouraged Zionist Jews to come to Palestine. The 1948 Declaration of Independence is widely considered as the starting point for an occupation that has triggered many wars and impacted the whole Middle East and the world. Soon after the creation of Israel, the forced displacement of Palestinians, known as the Nakba, or catastrophe, began. Several hundred Palestinian villages were razed to the ground, and their residents were forced to flee and were never allowed to return. Today, the refugees and their descendants around the world number 5 million. Israel has been seizing more Palestinian lands over the past decades and keeps building on them. What's now left for the Palestinians is a tiny fraction of their original homeland. This map shows how Palestinian territories have been shrinking over the past decades. The Israeli violations of Palestinians' rights are many. To Israeli authorities, Palestinian lives don't matter at all. The Israeli regime does not hesitate to kill. Meanwhile, the regime has engaged in demographic engineering, discrimination in access to education, healthcare, and building rights. Just days ago, leading international rights group Human Rights Watch issued a report condemning Israel for committing the crimes of apartheid and persecution against Palestinians in the occupied Palestinian territories. In 2017, the UN Economic and Social Commission for Western Asia issued a damning report on Israeli practices in occupied Palestinian territories. The report said Israel has established an apartheid regime that oppresses the Palestinians as a whole. But for Israel, such reports and repeated UN resolutions are no big concern, as the regime has full U.S. diplomatic cover. Meanwhile, Palestinians have been let down by some Arab states. Last year, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Sudan recognized Israel and normalized their ties with the regime. Palestinians are outraged by the normalization, which they believe is threatening their planned statehood. Palestinians say those Arab states are stabbing them in the back. Palestinians know all too well that their options are very limited at the moment. As many governments refuse to pressure the Israeli regime, it is hoped that resistance and popular grassroots campaigns against Israel will one day change things for the better.
Raising awareness, circulating these things on social media, holding your politicians accountable, also bring the campaign aid, help people in Palestine. You know, everybody can reach out to somebody in Palestine and let them videotape the scenario around them. Like, you know, Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, we always have campaign aids in Gaza. And, you know, when they get us video coverage of the houses inside and how they're living in their neighborhoods, this already by itself shows how this blockade and this occupation has treated these people and what status they're at right now. They're living in poverty. They're living in the worst conditions. And this is because of the occupation, nothing else.
American politician and lawyer Elliot Abrams, who has served in a number of U.S. administrations, has proposed to improve American foreign policy. In an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, Abrams argued that the U.S. is at a critical crossroads when it comes to the defense of American freedom, security, and prosperity. Abrams says around the world, the U.S. faces significant national security threats, among them revisionist powers, the spread of nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons, and transnational terrorism, which are all made more dangerous by renewed great power competition with China. Abrams believed none of those challenges will disappear if America abandons the international role it has maintained since World War II as what he called a superpower leader of the free world. Abrams also says that is why he is joining with 75 other national security scholars and practitioners to launch the Vandenberg Coalition, a new network committed to advancing what has been described as a strong and proud American foreign policy. But what is this war party and what purpose does it serve?
We will eliminate all of these people with this dual loyalty, like Elliot Abrams. Elliot Abrams is the son of Norman Podaritz, a son-in-law of Norman Podaritz and Mitch Dechter, a classic neocon, a man who's willing to break the laws of the United States of America in the interest of Israel. He had to get a pardon in order to get his job, his security clearance. We need to have a clear dividing line here between the people who serve Israel, like Elliot Abrams, who serve Israel's interests, and the people who serve America's interests.
Many believe this sounds more like the project for the New American Century, PNAC, which was active between the years of 1997 and 2006, was a new conservative think tank whose goal was to promote American global leadership. The group openly advocated for total global military domination, and many PNAC members held the highest level positions in the George W. Bush administration.
Yes, that's exactly what it is. Nothing has changed except the labels. These people were, for some reason, they didn't like Donald Trump. I don't understand this. He did everything that Israel wanted. But this, the problem here is that these people are always using front groups. They're always trying to disguise themselves as an American this or Republican that or conservative this. All of these labels are covers. They're disguises for the fact that these are Jews pursuing Jewish interests, this interest of the state of Israel and not the interest of the United States of America.
Elliot Elliot Abrams' proposal comes as the United States has already been actively engaged in multiple confrontations in the Middle East and East Asia. It's now a decades-long war on countries like Afghanistan and Iraq, and even Syria have led to nothing but deaths and destruction. The wars cost America trillions of dollars. However, numerous military manufacturers, including Lockheed Martin, Boeing, General Dynamics, and Northrop Grumman, have large contributions to U.S. wars by profiting the most from them. This is why growing arms investments mean a lot for international relations. Many believe this may be the reason behind the creation of the project suggested by Abrams. Meanwhile, Washington has been at a trade war with China for some years. It has also been initiating a potential altercation by keeping its presence in the South China Sea and other areas in the region. It seems that such comments by the likes of Abrams only serve the U.S. military manufacturers and the deep state, which support forever wars, as opposed to the policy of the new administration of President Joe Biden.
But if you're talking about America's interest, you're disguising once again the fact that this is Israel's interest. These are Jewish interests. And yeah, there is a military-industrial complex that profits from wars. That's true. But that all disguises the fact that what Elliot Abrams really represented here. So as I said at the beginning, I think this is a good idea. I think they should form a Jewish party. If you want Jewish interests, if you want America to serve Jewish interests, then vote for Elliot Abrams and all of his formerly known as neoconservative friends.
Biden's reluctance to continue down the path of neocons and other warmongers in the U.S. ruling establishment aside, the U.S. is practically unable to keep going down that road. On the other hand, multiple U.S. wars waged over the past decades indicate that the United States is a warning power, as it has not won any of them. Yet Washington wants to continue its wars and its costs. Most observers, strategists, and political scientists, as well as sitting and former officials in the U.S. and the wider West, believe that America's clout has long been under decline and the country is no longer capable of acting like the good cop it has portrayed itself to be.
New allegations are swirling around British Prime Minister Boris Johnson about misusing funds received from Conservative Party donations. The Prime Minister stands accused of infringing the law by using the funds to renovate his residence at number 11 Downing Street. The allegation has prompted an Electoral Commission probe into the matter, which can take months to complete. Johnson maintains that he has personally paid for the costs of the renovation.
Who initially, and Prime Minister, initially is the key word here, who initially paid for the redecoration of his Downing Street flat?
As for the latest stuff that he's bringing up, he should know that I've paid for Downing Street refurbishment personally, Mr. Speaker, and I contrast it. Any further declaration that I have to make, I will, I will be advised upon by Lord Guy.
However, the British Prime Minister did not clarify whether he initially made the payments.
Well, if any of the three reviews into his conduct find that he broke the ministerial code, then Johnson would be expected to resign, but just expected, is how it says. But the code has already proved useless, really, like in the case of Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon, which she did a lot worse. But really, I don't think the Electoral Commission, which is investigating, is conducting at least one of the investigations, will really want to bring down the leader of an elected government with a large majority.
The latest allegation, which is referred to by the British media as the sleaze row, comes only days before local elections across the country are scheduled to be held. A recent opinion poll now shows the ruling Conservatives are losing their lead over the opposition Labour Party. Apart from the redecoration scandal, there have been other unconfirmed reports that the Conservative Party donors have been solicited funds for personal matters. The Sunday Times has cited a British MP as saying that he had received a complaint from a donor who was asked to pay for Boris Johnson's child's nanny. A spokesperson for the Prime Minister's office dismissed the report, saying Johnson had paid all the childcare costs himself, but she didn't respond to a question about who had initially made the payment. But that's not the only report tarnishing the Prime Minister's image. He's recently been grilled about whether or not he had said he would rather see bodies piled up in their thousands than declare another nationwide lockdown, remarks he flatly rejects ever making.
Prime Minister.
No, Mr. Speaker, and I think what I think the Right Honourable Gentleman is a lawyer, I'm given to understand. I think that if he's going to repeat allegations like that, he should come to this House and substantiate those allegations and say where he heard them and who exactly is supposed to have said those. Who exactly is supposed to have said those things, Mr. Speaker? Because what I certainly can tell him, and he asked about the October decisions, they were very bitter.
The rules on parliamentarians' expenses were really tightened up more than 10 years ago, and a few MPs were forced to resign over that. But that means that a lot of the Westminster sleeves that we used to talk about all the time has been eliminated. I think the reason that this has become such a big issue is that the Labour Party opposition doesn't have any clear policies or even really broad politics.
Tories are now debating who's behind the leaks, with the majority of fingers now pointing at former aide to the Prime Minister, Dominic Cummins. In the meantime, the opposition Labour Party has accused the government of showing contempt against the British people by engaging in such infightings.
An audit by the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, has revealed that Washington's effort in February 2019 to send aid to Venezuela was part of a plot to change the legitimate government of President Nicolas Maduro in the oil-rich Latin American country. The USAID report noted that the aid offer was not planned in alignment with humanitarian principles, but for supporting pro-Western figure Juan Guaido. That is while Venezuela was grappling with chronic shortages of food and medicine. The document said materials sent to the Colombian border region in February 2019 were planned to be distributed by the allies of Venezuelan opposition figure Juan Guaido to reinforce his credibility. The U.S. administration, under the former President Donald Trump, planned for the aid supplies to be carried out by Guaido's allies across the Colombian border into Venezuela. However, the Venezuelan government blocked the aid convoys at the time, calling the U.S. move a violation of the country's sovereignty. In reaction to the audit, the Venezuelan Foreign Minister Jorge Arreaza said the U.S. offered aid to the oil-rich nation 2 years ago in a bid to overthrow the government in Caracas. Also, the Venezuelan Information Minister Freddy Nunez called the so-called U.S. humanitarian support an excuse in which Washington sought to break Venezuela's territorial sovereignty. Venezuela descended into political turmoil after opposition figure Juan Guaido unilaterally declared himself as the interim president in January 2019. He claimed Maduro's re-election in 2018 was fraudulent. The Trump administration recognized Guaido as the legitimate leader of Venezuela and publicly pursued a regime change policy against Maduro. Meanwhile, the Biden administration has reaffirmed the U.S. recognition of Guaido as the interim president and has ruled out negotiations with Maduro anytime soon. Washington has been pursuing a regime change in Venezuela and has imposed crippling sanctions on the country to force Maduro out of power. The organization USAID has been accused of political interference in the past. It has used aid and the notion of democracy promotion to interfere in countries like Russia and Cuba. Venezuela has been no exception.
Well, I would say yes, the U.S. does lose credibility when its plans get exposed, but that won't deter the United States from trying to push forward these plans. Really, what we have in the U.S. is there's one end goal, one end interest, and that interest is the interest of imperialism, of trying to open up markets and take resources from other nations that the U.S. either does not have enough of or would want to have more of. You know, one of those resources in terms of Venezuela being oil.
The U.S. has been after regime change in Venezuela for quite some time, especially during the presidency of the former president Hugo Chavez, was very vociferous in its anti-U.S. stance. The U.S. has refrained from recognizing Nicolas Maduro's re-election in 2018, freezing millions of dollars of Venezuelan money in U.S. bank accounts, and imposing sanctions on the crisis of the economy of the Latin American nation. What has been termed as economic terrorism Washington is attempting to use sanctions as a leverage to overthrow the legitimate government of Maduro. Last month, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro slammed Washington's plan to transfer $150 million of the country's frozen funds from offshore accounts to the opposition led by Juan Guaido. Maduro lashed out at both the U.S. government and the Venezuelan opposition, calling them a pile of gangster bandits. While freezing assets and slapping illegal sanctions on countries that refuse to submit to Washington's hegemonic policies is nothing new. The U.S. sanctions have directly targeted Venezuelan people who are stuck between the coronavirus pandemic and an economic crisis. There's also the case of the failed U.S.-backed coup plot. Venezuelan security forces arrested dozens of people, including two Americans, after a beach invasion allegedly aimed to overthrow President Nicolas Maduro. This was a plot which involved U.S.-backed opposition leader Juan Guaido. A Florida-based ex-Green Beret, Jordan Goodreau, told the Associated Press that he was working with the two American men in a mission launched early to liberate Venezuela.
I would point out that a lot of these failures are contemporary. They're things that are happening recently, and not to say that they weren't failures in the past, but we've seen how a lot of the regime change efforts in the past were far more successful than they have been recently. I think part of the problem, for the United States at least, is that the world is becoming a lot stronger and a lot more aware of some of the tactics that the United States is using.
Like other countries in South America, Venezuela is facing a harsh new pandemic wave, fueled by more infectious virus variants coming from neighboring Brazil. Experts say the sanctions, used as a tool for regime change, have no effect on the stability of the Maduro administration, but impact the socioeconomic condition of ordinary people amidst the COVID-19 crisis.
Allahumma rabba shahri Ramadan.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, Instructions for Preachers. Brothers and sisters, the holy month of Ramadan is an opportunity for all of us to engage in preaching Islam. A preacher should strive his best to speak nothing but truth and have sincerity in his preaching. He must pay attention towards it. In addition to that, he must endeavor to keep himself immune from the tongue's injuries. He should not say anything unknowingly, and should not lie about Allah, the Glorious, the Exalted, and the Holy Prophet and Ahlul Bayt. The words which give the smell of egotism and self-glorification should not be uttered. The speech which intentionally or unintentionally results in disturbance, loss, and deviation should be renounced, even though if the deviation of his speech is for the sake of proving a certain clarification. For example, for responding to the doubts raised by apostates and hostile elements, but those listening to them may not understand and comprehend them properly and correctly, thus resulting in their becoming further deviated. He should not speak in a manner that the listener become hopeless because of fear, or on contrary, due to too much hope it becomes proud and arrogant. So brothers and sisters, there are those two types of speakers or preachers. One of those types is like which gives people way too much hope. Hope that actually results in laziness. And then there's another set of speakers who make people so afraid and so fearful that again they become useless and ineffective.
رمضان المستبين جاء بالنور المبين رمضان 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 القانتين.
Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing the instructions of Islam for preachers. So we said the holy month of Ramadan is an opportunity where we are all expected to engage in preaching this beautiful religion of Islam. While speaking about the prophets and other distinguished personalities, a preacher should not and must not speak in an exaggerated or rhetorical manner so that the listener might develop misconception regarding them or might open their tongue in their criticism. Likewise, a preacher should be careful to speak regarding religious commandments. He should not speak in a manner which would result in weakening of the listener's faith about Allah, the Holy Prophet, Ahlul Bayt, the religion itself, and the Islamic law, which is also known as Sharia. Sometimes, you know, in order for us to be able to say something new, something different, something out of the box, we end up saying things, the preachers end up saying things that are not really Islamic in nature. There's sometimes some sort of a, you know, deviation, you can say, or some sort of a thought that is our personal thought and is not part of the Islamic thought process. This is where the preachers have to be very careful. While we acknowledge and know that preaching has great rewards, preaching Islam to others has great rewards, but it is a dangerous path. We have to be careful when we're preaching, the things that we say, the thoughts that we plant in people's minds, all of that has to be very calculated. We cannot make people too fearful, and we cannot make them too hopeful either, as Islam has commanded. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You know that I will be better, that I will be stronger if you were by my side.
What you heard was an IRIB English Radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.